Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Facts Heard conference call. As a reminder, today's conference is being recorded. And at this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Dr. Jeff Levy. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much, and good morning, everyone. I'm Jeff Levy. I'm Executive Director of Trust for America's Health. Thanks for joining us today for the release of the Facts Heard, an injury prevention policy report, which we are co-releasing with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. You can find the full report and state-by-state materials at our website, which is www.healthyamericans.org. I'm pleased to be joined today by Corinne Peek-Assa, Professor and Associate Dean for Research at the College of Public Health at the University of Iowa, who is also representing the Society for the Advancement of Violence and Injury Research, known as SAVER. We are also joined by Amber Williams, who is Executive Director of the Safe States Alliance, which is a professional association of experts around the country who work on the ground to strengthen the practice of injury and violence prevention. I'll start by providing a brief overview of the report, hand the call over to Corey to discuss what injury research and trends tell us, and then Amber will talk about the current national investment in injury prevention, and I'll provide a short conclusion before we open the call up to questions. One person dies from an injury every 3 minutes in the United States, and injuries are the leading cause of death for all Americans between the ages of 1 and 44. They are responsible for nearly 193,000 deaths, and more than 27 million Americans seek medical treatment for injuries each year. Injuries are not just acts of fate. Research shows they are pretty predictable, and they are actually very preventable. In the Facts Heard, we look at injury trends across the country, including death rate trends, and a report card of policies that highlight action states can be taking to help reduce injuries and violence. Injury rates vary dramatically around the country. To just give you an example of that variability, the 8 states with the highest rates of injury have more than twice as many deaths per year as the state with the lowest rate. Evidence-based strategies can actually help prevent and reduce everything from motor vehicle crashes to homicides to drug overdoses. Overall, West Virginia has the highest rate of injury deaths at 97.9 deaths per 100,000 people, and New York the lowest at 40.3 deaths per 100,000 people. Since we last did this report 4 years ago, the injury death rates have increased significantly in 17 states, remained stable in 24 states, and decreased in 9 states. Drug overdoses and other poisonings are the leading cause of injury deaths in the United States, at nearly 44,000 a year. These deaths have more than doubled in the past 14 years, and around half of them are related to prescription drugs. Prescription drug abuse is a national epidemic, but it impacts some states much more than others. West Virginia has the highest number of overdose and poisoning deaths, 33.5 per 100,000 people. 5 states had rates above 20 deaths per 100,000 people, while seven states had rates below 10 deaths per 100,000 people, an exponential difference. In the past 4 years, poisoning deaths increased in 26 states and Washington, D.C., and only decreased in 6. They are now responsible for more deaths than motor vehicle crashes in 36 states and Washington, D.C. What's clear from all this variation and changes in trends over time is that different strategies have an impact and can make a real difference in reducing injuries and violence. It's not rocket science, but it requires common sense and an investment in good public health practice. In our report card, we highlight 10 key indicators of areas where it's clearly possible to make a difference in preventing and reducing injuries and violence with some concerted efforts. These indicators are not a comprehensive evaluation, but they are a snapshot of efforts states are taking across a range of risk areas. The scores fell across a wide range, from a high of 9 in New York to a low of 2 in Florida, Iowa, Missouri, and Montana. I'll now pass the call over to Corinne Peek-Assa to discuss more about the research and policy trends that contributed to the report card. Corey?
Thanks, Jeff. Just to introduce myself again, I'm Corinne Peek-Assa. I'm a professor and associate dean for research at the College of Public Health at the University of Iowa. And on today's call, I'm also representing the Society for the Advancement of Violence and Injury Research, known as SAVER, which includes experts and academics who research injury and violence trends, and we evaluate what strategies work best to help reduce them. As a country, we often focus on new troubling trends, like what Jeff spoke about in the prescription drug epidemic, increases in fall-related deaths and traumatic brain injuries, but we can't afford to neglect persistent problems like motor vehicle crashes, drowning, assault, and suicide. We have a good research base and track record for reducing injuries when we invest in the right places. For the FACTS Hurt Report card, we looked at a wide range of concerns, and I'll mention some of those key findings. As Jeff mentioned, the prescription drug epidemic is really troubling. It's grown so quickly over the past 15 years. Now, more than 2 million Americans misuse prescription drugs, and this is fueling a rise in heroin use, as some people are transitioning from prescription painkillers to heroin, and heroin is often a cheaper and easier substance to access. Heroin deaths have quadrupled since the year 2000. Two indicators that we looked at can help curb prescription drug misuse or the harm caused by their misuse. First, every state except Missouri has some form of prescription drug monitoring program. These are important for helping to track doctor shopping or any overuse of prescription drugs. However, there's a wide variation in these prescription drug monitoring programs. Only 25 states require mandatory use of these programs by healthcare providers in at least some circumstances. This is good progress, but even within those states, the requirements can vary from regular use by doctors to use only in very limited circumstances. In addition, 34 states and Washington, D.C. now have rescue drug laws in place. These expand the ability of lay people to have access to a prescription drug called naloxone that can be used to counteract drug overdoses. We also looked at a number of indicators related to reducing motor vehicle crashes. As a nation, we've made great progress in reducing deaths from crashes over time. They've decreased by 25% in the past decade, but 33,000 Americans still die, and 2.3 million Americans are treated in hospitals for motor vehicle crash injuries every year. They are the leading cause of death among teenagers, accounting for one-third of all teenager deaths. Seatbelt laws save around 12,000 lives a year, but still, only 34 states and Washington, D.C. have primary seatbelt laws. Child safety seats, booster seats, and seatbelts save around 12,200 children's lives every year, but only 35 states and Washington, D.C. require car seats or boosters until the age of 8, as is recommended by the American Academy of Pediatrics. We found that 21 states had drunk driving laws that required ignition interlocks for some first-time offenders, meaning that if a person has any offense for drunk driving, they must use a device installed in their car to monitor if they've been drinking before they can turn the car on. And most states have some form of graduated driver's license, which limits the time and or numbers of passengers for new teenage drivers. DL has been shown to help reduce crashes, but only 10 states restrict nighttime driving for teens starting at 10 p.m., which is the strongest recommendation based on the evidence. In addition, we also looked at violence trends. One area that is particularly troubling is that suicides have remained consistent and high, at around 41,000 deaths per year for 20 years. More than 1 million adults attempt suicide each year, and 17% of teenagers seriously consider suicide each year. During this same time period, over the past 20 years, homicide rates have dropped significantly by 42%. The bad news is there are still 16,000 homicides a year, and the rate of young black male homicide victims is 10 times higher than for the overall population. In the report, we found that 31 states had homicide rates at or below the national goal, which is 5.5 for every 100,000 people. Research continues to show that many forms of violence are often interrelated and share the same root causes, and research has helped develop intervention strategies that states and communities can use to reduce violence, from interpersonal violence to sexual assault to rape to bullying and homicide. Another major trend we looked at, which is a big problem that does not get enough attention, is that 1 in 3 Americans over the age of 64 experiences a serious fall each year. Falls are the most common non-fatal injury, and the number of fall-related injuries is expected to increase significantly as the baby boomer cohort ages. Only 13 states have fall-related deaths under the national goal, which is 7.2 per 100,000 people. Fall prevention programs have been shown to help reduce falls and the severity of injury caused by falls among seniors. I recommend checking out the full report for more details and other topics covered, but I'd like to conclude by reiterating that research shows that the vast majority of injuries are predictable, preventable, and avoidable, and that by investing in more successful public policies, programs, and public education campaigns, we can give Americans the tools they need to stay safe and protect their families. And with that, I'll pass the call over to Amber Williams.
Thanks, Corey. I'm Amber Williams, the Executive Director of the Safe States Alliance. We are a professional membership association representing experts who work in state and local health departments, hospitals, universities, and other settings to implement injury and violence prevention strategies in communities across the country. Historically, U.S. investment in injury prevention has been very limited. Injuries have the second highest medical costs of all preventable health issues, but injury prevention receives only about 5% of the CDC's total budget. In fact, it adds up to about 28 cents per person. According to a study we conduct in 2013, the investments through state health departments ranged very widely from state to state, from a low of less than 15 cents per person to more than a dollar in just four states. Yet, there is an annual cost of approximately $1,300 per person for injuries sustained in a single year. Think about what we could do if we really stepped up and invested in preventing injuries at a level that matches the problem they pose. The Facts Hurt report contains specific recommendations in each issue area, but we also have three overarching recommendations. First, we recommend increasing resources and workforce for injury and violence prevention. Currently, public health departments and researchers do not have the support that they need to fully implement many promising strategies. As Corey mentioned, it's important to invest in emerging troubling concerns, like the prescription drug overdose epidemic, but we still need to sustain an ongoing investment in preventing all forms of injury and violence and make sure we're not diverting funds from one concern at the expense of another. Second, we must increase investments in injury prevention research. Research has generated strong evidence that a number of strategies can reduce a wide range of injuries. For example, looking at the strategies for limiting texting and driving and other distracted driving crashes, and making strides in understanding and addressing the root causes and ways to prevent violence. But that needs resources to keep moving further. Thirdly, we need to strengthen partnerships between public health and other sectors. Injuries have a wide range of causes and requires working across sectors to develop and implement strategies. For example, violence prevention efforts typically involve community organizations, social services, education, law enforcement, the judicial system, and other areas. And efforts like Complete Streets and Safe Routes to School initiatives show how public health can work with other sectors, like transportation, economic development, and other areas to achieve multiple goals, including reducing injuries, improving health, and achieving many other improvements in the community at the same time. I'll conclude with that and pass the call back over to Jeff.
Thanks, Amber. We appreciate the opportunity to work with Safe States Alliance and the Society for the Advancement of Violence and Injury Research and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation on the Facts Hurt Report. It's a rewarding area to work on since it's so clear that public health policies and strategies can have a big impact. But we need to stay vigilant and support researchers to continue to advance strategies and practitioners to implement them. Successful public health policies, programs, and education campaigns can help give Americans the tools they need to stay safe and protect their families. With that, operator, let's go ahead and open up the call for any questions. But just before that, just a reminder that the report and state-by-state materials are available on TIFA's website at healthyamericans.org.
Thank you, Dr. Lee. And if you would like to ask a question at this time, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. And if you are using a speakerphone, please be sure that your mute function is turned off to allow that signal to reach our equipment. And again, star 1 to ask a question at this time, and we'll pause just a moment to assemble our queue. And again, just as a reminder, it is star 1 to ask a question. And we'll take our first question from Tyler Pager with USA Today.
Hi, thanks for doing this call. I'm interested to hear a little bit more about the drug overdose-related deaths. I've seen that, and the report shows that it's nearly doubled in 14 years and is now the leading cause of injury-related deaths. My first question is, has this always been the leading cause? And second, kind of what would you attribute these factors to, and kind of what are some strategies that you outline in the report that you hope states will implement to decrease this epidemic, as you call it?
Sure. So this is a growing problem, and it has, you know, when we released the report last year, 4 years ago, rather, that was one of the first times where we started to see in a large number of states that drug overdose became outpaced motor vehicle injuries, or overdose outpaced motor vehicle injuries, and now we're seeing it in, I think, 36 states. So that's a growing trend, and that is reflected, you know, it by a dramatic increase in drug overdoses. It is not just that things like motor vehicle accidents are going down. And, you know, that's a reflection of a number of challenges, ready access to prescription drugs. But the overdose problem is not just related to prescription drugs, but where it leads on to, which is use of heroin and other injectable drugs, which then results in not just the threat of overdose deaths, but also outbreaks of hepatitis C and HIV, just as we've seen in Scott County in Indiana. So we identify in this report a series of things that we think states ought to be doing, including wider use of prescription drug monitoring programs, including making naloxone available as to counter overdose. But there's also a series of other policy steps that can be taken, and you know, we issued an entire report on this not too long ago. Everything from more prescriber education to more medically assisted treatment for people who do become addicted, so that we can have a multi-pronged approach to this. Corey or Amber, do you want to add anything to that?
This has actually begun to receive more attention and funding, and in fact, later this year, CDC will be funding, hopefully, up to 16 states at about $1 million a year through a new program called Prescription Drug Overdose Prevention for States. And so this will allow states to begin to, you know, maximize and enhance their prescription drug monitoring programs, conduct policy evaluations, and understand better what is working from both policy and programmatic strategies in terms of reducing these prescription drug-related deaths.
I'd like to add that effective policies don't come out of nowhere. They come from years of building a safety culture that throughout from an individual to the policymakers, that there's recognition and acceptance of that policy approach and also the ability to put that approach in place. And so, for example, the prescription drug monitoring programs are possible in part because of more interagency and interprofessional healthcare communication, so better collaboration, and also from increased technology that allows us to track prescriptions and multi-drug prescriptions better. And I just want to call out the field of injury prevention for being very proactive in interagency collaboration.
And can you just remind me the names of the who spoke second and who spoke third?
Second speaker is Corinne Peek Asa.
Okay.
The University
and
of
second
Iowa.
Speaker was Amber Williams.
The second speaker or the third speaker?
Second.
It was
Jeff, then Corinne, then Amber.
Okay. And then just wanted to clarify one thing. So the first time that you really saw drug overdose become the leading cause of injury deaths was about 4 years ago. Is that correct?
That was the beginning of the crossover, yes.
Okay.
And that obviously varies from state to state.
But as a general national trend, it was around 4 years ago that this kind of came to the forefront.
Yes.
Okay.
And we'll take our next question from Tony Lees with the Des Moines Register.
Hi, my question is specifically about naloxone and how much difference it makes to have it available to families to use immediately. We're one of the only states that doesn't allow that.
Yeah, so being a fellow Iowan, thank you so much for being on the call. This is Corinne.
Sure.
I'll let Jeff and Amber chime in. But I'll just say really quickly, the quicker you can intervene on an overdose, the better the outcome, the more likely to prevent a death. So it is incredibly important to be able to respond as quickly as possible, even, you know, before emergency responders can get there.
Is there a safety issue in families doing this themselves?
No.
Sorry, this is Amber. There are many states that are beginning to look at lay people providing access to naloxone, and there are different methods for how naloxone can be taken. And so I think that as we are beginning to better understand who is the best provider for naloxone and how it should be given, we'll have a better answer to that question. But in many states, they are beginning to explore having both peers as well as family members having access to it, as well as emergency providers and pharmacists.
And I think, you know, another reason for having broader access is not just that it is more readily available, but I think it also communicates then the seriousness of these drugs and the potential danger. So if, you know, this is, for example, co-prescribed with these drugs, then the people who are appropriately getting these drugs as treatment for pain or what other condition it may be used for will probably take greater care because they've been warned and really given, you know, a very stark reminder about the potential dangers around misuse or overdose.
Is there any concern that it would give folks using heroin a feeling that it's not as dangerous, that if they overdose, somebody can just use this to bring them back?
There's certainly no evidence to suggest that. That isn't, I think, why people are driven to use drugs. And I think we've seen with similar harm reduction initiatives, such as syringe exchange, that those do not increase drug use, but actually access to these kinds of harm reduction programs may actually increase people seeking out treatment.
Thank you.
And just as a reminder, everyone, that is star one if you'd like to ask a question at this time. And we'll go next to Glennis Borg with West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Great. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. Thanks for taking my call. I just have a couple of questions. What do you think accounts for the fact that West Virginia is the worst ranked but has taken 7 of 10 steps to prevent injuries overall?
So, you know, I think, and I think Corinne and Amber can also speak to this, you know, having the policies in place does not change a situation overnight. It takes time for those policies to make a difference. West Virginia has certainly taken a lot of steps, particularly on the prescription drug abuse front, very recently. And certainly we hope, you know, if we do this 4 years from now, we'll begin to see a difference. But it takes time for those policies and programs to make a difference.
Another important component of policy effectiveness also is how enforced the policy is, how well accepted the policy is by the public. Are they complying with things that, you know, require their individual behavior, like actually putting on the seatbelt to be in compliance with the law? And I'm not saying that West Virginia is any worse than other states in those issues, but it is. Those are critical components of the policies being effective. I can also say that we see higher injury rates in states that have disproportionately older populations and states that have a higher proportion of their population in rural areas, because in rural areas there's a decreased access to health care, including emergency care. There are higher risks for things like occupational fatalities and injury for motor vehicle crashes. So it does lead to some special risk circumstances that are not unique to West Virginia.
Yeah, that's very helpful. I also have a question, and maybe this isn't the right forum for this, but I just wanted to put it out there. Is anybody researching why so many people are self-destructing with, say, drugs and suicide? Is there any research on that? Again, it might not be the right place to ask. I don't know.
Yes, there is. And I would say there's an increasing focus of public health on suicide. It's been studied in psychology for, you know, decades, and also in public health. But public health is really focused on primary prevention of suicide. And so the CDC funds a number of injury control research centers. There's one CDC-funded injury control research center in Rochester, New York, that focuses only on suicide prevention. And many others also do work in suicide prevention.
And as far as drug overdoses, why so many kids and younger people especially are self-destructing? Any thoughts?
Well, I think part of the challenge that we're seeing now is the relative accessibility of certain drugs and lower, some of this is almost a market issue of some drugs being much less expensive and therefore much more accessible. We also know that during economic downturns and during times of difficulty, we tend to see people more engaged in this kind of drug use.
And as an example, I would also add that really related to prescription drug overdoses, we're finding that the age of that is most impacted are really middle-aged Americans rather than the youth. And so where we're seeing many of the deaths are really in a more middle-aged age range and more male.
Oh, that's really interesting. Thanks for sharing.
Yeah, and some of that derives from initially, legal prescribing of these drugs. And I think part of the challenge here is, can we find better prescribing practices for physicians who are dealing with pain?
And we'll take our next question from Lisa McCormick with WDAF-TV.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I am a producer at a TV station in Missouri, which has the distinction of having the only state without a prescription drug monitoring program. I wondered if you could talk about concerns you would have about that, and then just to follow up, the chief opponent of this effort has said one of his concerns is privacy issues. So I'm curious if there have been any privacy issues that have developed in other states that have this type of program? Has anyone, for example, hacked into these systems? If you could talk a little bit about that, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. Yeah, Missouri is an anomaly on the PDMP. This has turned out to be a very important tool, not just for the health to actually treat this more as a public health problem, and less as a law enforcement problem, so that clinicians can know when a patient is doctor shopping, when a patient has received multiple prescriptions, a pharmacy can have a better idea of what is going on. We have actually urged that this be better integrated into the electronic health record, so the privacy that is associated with a health record would also be associated with the PDMP when it is used in the context of the health care delivery system. Obviously, there is a law enforcement component to this as well, because some of this is related to illegal activity. But it is our hope to, in using PDMPs and emphasizing their value in a healthcare setting, that we will get earlier intervention to prevent abuse and to get people into treatment who have developed a problem. I don't know of issues of any confidentiality concerns, and again, if the more we integrate this into the electronic medical record, the less likely this is to happen. I don't know if Corinne or Amber have anything to add on that.
This is Amber, and the only thing I would add is I think that PDMP data has also been a very critical tool for public health and research to better understand where the issues may be from state to state and community to community, because they aren't always the same, and this allows folks to better target prevention efforts. And so while I'm not aware of any hacks into PDMP data, I don't want to underestimate the tool, the use of the tool beyond clinicians and law enforcement for public health and better understanding and targeting prevention.
Thank you.
And we'll go next to Melissa Allison with Utah Public Radio.
Hi. Thanks for this conference this morning. I wanted to know, Utah is known for its many outdoor activities, and I was wondering if that was taken into consideration in the research and reporting of this in regards to injuries.
So I can talk a little bit, this is Corinne, as an epidemiologist, about sort of how we know about those injuries, and we don't have really good national data that codes what the person was doing. We code what was the cause. Was it a fall? Were they struck by an object? Was it machinery? Was it a traffic crash? Was it a firearm? And what those exact injuries were. So it's a little hard to pick out injuries from recreational use. But we have seen that things like falls are one of the fast increasing types of injury, as are traumatic brain injuries tied to sports and recreation. So I think that in public health, we want people out there moving around as much as they can. What we want to create is a very safe environment. So, you know, when you're hiking in the beautiful mountains, you're not risking death. So, you know, the environment and policies can be very effective in helping, you know, allow healthy behavior, but trying to keep that as safe as possible.
Can I ask just two more questions?
Sure.
Okay. Do we know why people are turning to prescription drugs or, you know, what is the cause of that? Why? I mean, not to overdose on purpose, but.
Right, right. And these are accidental overdoses, and we should note that overall suicide rates have been stable over time, but increasingly, the deaths we have seen from overdose, whether it's intentional or not, have been going up. You know, I think the causes are one that people are getting pain, you know, these addictive painkillers as part of medical treatment that is sometimes not being adequately monitored, and people are becoming addicted, and that leads down a pathway. And in part because there are challenges sometimes in securing these drugs, and young people perhaps not understanding that these might be dangerous. You know, there can be social environments where these drugs are used. But as I think Corinne noted earlier, the majority of the problem around prescription drugs is actually among older Americans, and who probably initially, or middle-aged Americans, who initially started using these drugs in the context of some medical treatment.
Are there warning signs that patients can look for to indicate that they might be becoming addicted to a drug?
Sure. I mean, you know, I think the burden should not, obviously, patients should be aware that if they are needing to use the drugs on an increasing basis, you know, at higher and higher doses, something isn't working right. Whether their pain isn't being managed properly and or they are perhaps getting addicted, but the burden shouldn't just fall to the individual. The burden really needs to fall on the healthcare provider to make sure that they are monitoring how a patient is using these drugs and not over-prescribing. Certainly, you know, there's a balancing act here. People with serious types of pain need these drugs and need to have good access to them. But we also know too many instances where, you know, people, you know, have oral surgery or something like that, and are given a month's worth of drugs when that is not what they need, because if they are continuing to have pain after several days, they should be back at their healthcare provider getting a reevaluation. And so finding that right balance between those who need those drugs on a regular basis, being able to have access to it, and making sure that we're not over-prescribing so people there isn't as much of a risk of addiction, or we can intervene early, I think that's the balancing act that we're all looking for.
And then my last question, you mentioned 1 in 3 people over 64 fall and have injuries. There's been conversation about elderly people falling because actually their hips are fracturing and that's why they're falling. Was that looked into? Has that been confirmed at all?
Corinne or Amber, do you want to talk to that?
You know, I'm not aware of, this is Amber, I'm not aware of the hip fracture occurring before the fall. I'm not aware of any information about that. I do know that hip fractures are typically, a result of many falls. So, Corinne, I don't know, if you have anything related to that.
Yeah, and I think it's really hard to tell when that happens, but there can be evidence of a lot of microfractures and generally weakening of the bones as well as the muscle tissue and other cognitive, even normal decline can all contribute to increase in fall risk. But whatever that predisposing factor is, the impact of the fall is what's going to create, you know, the break that has to get set at the hospital and leads to the immobilization that can set off a secondary chain of negative health events that can ultimately lead into loss of independence. Falls are one of the leading causes of loss of independence, and then, of course, also death.
Okay, thank you so much.
And this is Amber again. I would add that in many cases there are a series of minor falls that don't require health care or aren't treated in health care settings that may lead to a more serious fall that then is. And so that may also be part of what Corey is referring to.
Yes. And so from a policy standpoint, one of the elements of the new Accountability Act is that hospitals are encouraged and hopefully required to do fall screening because physicians may not always be aware of the falls their patients have had and then implement some inpatient fall programs.
Thank you.
And just as a reminder, everyone, that is star one to ask a question at this time. And we'll take our next question from Josh James with WKY Radio.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I see I'm in Kentucky, by the way, Lexington, Kentucky. I see we've got the second highest drug overdose rate. Obviously, our problem started with prescription drugs. We had legislation cracking down on that. Then the problem seemed to shift to heroin. Now we have legislation dealing with that. What recommendations do you have for states, I guess, trying to stop this cycle of simply moving from one drug to another?
Well, I think the bottom line is, you know, Kentucky is really a model for its response in terms of putting the policies in place. I think the challenge that Kentucky has faced is that you have a very large epidemic and therefore to some degree are playing catch up. If I were looking at other state, if I were in another state and was seeing some of the trends that are in the data across the country, I would actually look to some of the models that Kentucky has put in place to make sure that I had those in place early so that they would not just be a response to the problem, but actually could become a prevention tool as well.
All right. Thanks for that.
Sure.
And we'll take our next question from Shemaine Mills with Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks for taking my call. Wisconsin's an outlier with first drunk driving. It's not a crime. It's a citation. And I'm wondering if you think this plays a role in our consistently high number of drunk driving accidents and deaths here in the state.
With Corinne, and I would venture to say in a word, yes. The role of policy and enforcement for road traffic safety has many features that have made it so effective over the last years, and part of that is growing a safety culture so that the public has not just the perception that they might get caught for something, but that it really is truly not acceptable to behave that way on the road. And there is some consistency between the public sentiments for safety culture, the extent to which policymakers prioritize safety, and how strong the laws are. And I think what states have learned over time is that spending a lot of effort and money on the really serious repeat offenders is sometimes not as effective at a population level as putting efforts upstream, which would be at the first offense or even before that.
Thank you.
And we'll take our next question from Hannah Schwartz with the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. I have two questions. The first is, so now that we're kind of seeing more policies that are cracking down on kind of over-prescription of these prescription drugs by physicians, do you guys think that we're going to see a decrease in overdoses in the next few years? Overdose deaths.
Well, we certainly hope so. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I echo Jeff. This is Amber. I think that, you know, there are many promising policies that we are hoping to continue to see spread across states in an effort to continue to, you know, address this issue. And I think that in the hope is to prevent the addiction and I'll assure that people don't turn to heroin as has happened in many states. And so by having more stronger guidance to physicians and having a better understanding of, you know, when and how much is appropriate for these very addicting opiates, that we would begin to get a handle on truly treating pain appropriately and then also making sure that it doesn't turn into an addiction and spiral.
And thanks so much. My other question is about the people who we're seeing the most overdose deaths with. So, you know, kind of middle-aged men who have been using prescription drugs. I'm curious because they already have a higher tolerance and perhaps a better understanding of what their body can tolerate, but they're the ones overdosing most. Why is that?
Well, I think as Jeff said earlier, many men are being treated for pain, and with the way that opiates work, it tends to require more to receive the same response as you continue treatment. And so I think that as we have a better understanding of you know, for what reasons should opiates be given, what are some other appropriate treatments, such as physical therapy or other pain treatments? I think that, you know, having a better understanding of other options for the treatment of pain will help us. But I would venture to say that, you know, that these opiates are very addictive and really require very careful oversight by both the patient and physician.
Great, thank you.
And again, ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder, it is star one to ask a question at this time. And we'll go next to Natalie Miller with the Observer Reporter.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My question, I really just have one question. It's kind of a lengthy one, though. Amber, I think that you talked about strengthening partnerships between public health and other sectors and reducing these types of injuries and deaths. Here in Washington, Pennsylvania, we are having a heroin epidemic, which is leading to related crimes, specifically thefts, burglaries, retail thefts. Can you give a specific example of a partnership that has been effective in reducing this type of thing, or perhaps even a potential collaboration that could be beneficial or that you would like to see?
I think that's a great question. In public health, many of the issues that we deal with, including prescription drug overdoses and now the rising heroin related deaths, do require a cross collaboration across the community to address. And so certainly having public health and law enforcement and other community organizations at the table to truly understand where there are issues within the community to have a stronger response So I think that there are many examples of that related to violence prevention, particularly, you know, most notably we've seen such a rising violence in cities like Baltimore, yet there are very effective programs that are going on to interrupt the violence, such as Safe Streets and programs like that. So I don't have an example particularly to addressing thefts related to heroin, but certainly there are many public health examples of working across sectors to combine the efforts of many professional organizations as well as community members to take back communities.
And I think we see a growing number of people in the law enforcement field recognizing that the heroin epidemic is first a health issue and as well as a criminal justice issue, and that the first goal is to get people into treatment, and that will get them off the streets, it will get them to stop using, it will get them then, it is in a sense primary, you know, what we would consider treatment is really, from the public health standpoint, is primary prevention for crime. And that's where there is sort of a coming together of a shared interest between those two fields. And I think in a number of communities, we are seeing more and more sheriffs and law enforcement officials and police commissioners coming forward and saying that. And, you know, using, you know, communities that are using drug courts, for example, as a way of directing people into treatment rather than into the prison system, so, you know, where sometimes these behaviors only get reinforced, I think is a good example of how the two worlds are coming together.
And I would add that we have really strong past relationships to build on. We've done a lot of work with law enforcement and others related to motor vehicle injury prevention, so working from both the education and policy angles of both in assuring that people are using the right restraint in every car ride, as well as enforcing laws in communities such as DWI and seatbelt laws that allow, I think, our sectors to work together and build on our strengths to really reduce injury-related deaths to those issues.
I could give you, a specific example of where public health has played a role in this focus on violence prevention, very applicable to what's going on with community crime related to drug use. So public health was really the first field to focus on primary prevention of violence. So we had the law enforcement and justice system that was responsible for people once they'd committed a crime. We had the medical system that was largely responsible for treating the victims. But it was really public health that brought them together to think and identify first how interrelated the experiences of crime victimization and perpetration are throughout the life cycle, how child traumatic experiences can influence all kinds of health behaviors, including crime perpetration. You know, so I think there is an example of how public health not only brought two fields together that hadn't worked together a lot in the past, but really changed the way they focused on a problem to be one of working together upstream, rather than, you know, working with the bodies that were already thrown in the water.
Thank you very much.
And we'll go next to Frank Gluck with Fort Myers News Press.
Hi, thanks for doing this today. I wonder if one of you could talk about why injury deaths in Florida rates here have dropped in the last 4 years. We have an older population, certainly had a issue with prescription drugs and now heroin. I wonder what accounts for that decline. Is it drug overdoses? Is it vehicle crashes or crime or what?
I would need to spend a little time, and we could probably do this offline, looking at some of the specific rates by broken down, comparing the report from 4 years ago to today. Right now, all I can tell you is what the overall change has been. But I do know that, you know, Florida has taken a fairly aggressive role in addressing the prescription drug epidemic, and so that may well account for part of that decline.
And once again, everyone, that is star one if you'd like to ask a question at this time. And we have no questions holding in queue.
All right. Well, I want to thank Corinne and Amber in particular for joining us today, and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation for supporting this report, but also all of you for joining us. And remember, the report and materials on a state-by-state basis are available at our website, healthyamericans.org, but also feel free to contact us if you have any additional questions. Thank you all for joining us.
And this does conclude today's conference. We thank you all for your participation.